Freedom News Hour with Walt Thiessen, Jake Towne, and Melinda Pillsbury Foster, Thursdays at 6 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know that talking about a revolution sounds whisper? Don't you know talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper? While they're standing in the welfare lines.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here for an hour talking about the financial system, the monetary system, what's going on with inflation worries and so forth. Gene DiNardo is off this week. He's actually traveling. Jake Towne is supposed to be with me. He's not here yet, but hopefully he's going to be calling in so that we can carry on some conversation. But in the meantime, we're going to go through, I'm going to go through some of the interesting stuff that has happened this past week. It's been a relatively slow news week compared to other weeks in the past. So I'm actually going to dig back maybe 2 weeks worth to a variety of things that have been going on. Most of what I'm going to be talking about is regarding the financial system itself. We often branch out to a variety of issues, newsworthy things going on. There's stuff obviously going on in Libya now with the Obama administration deciding to send non-lethal materials over there, and we may get into more details about that if Jake comes on, but for the moment, I'm just going to stick with the basic monetary system itself. And I'm also going to cue you in on something that I've been working on in my off hours, such as they are. I am actually in the process of putting together a video version of the Freedom News Hour, whose sole purpose is to explain in detail how the monetary system works, how the banking system works, and how it really was the root cause of the financial crisis in 2008, as well as the root cause of the inflation that is now hitting us and is starting to ramp up this summer, as we've reported here in, on the Freedom News Hour in the past. And there will be more information about that video as we get closer to release date. I'm anticipating a release probably somewhere in the first or second week of May. We've got a little bit more filming to do on it. I'm actually doing it with a good friend of mine named Richard Blackwell because he lives here in the same town I do. Jake, unfortunately, lives about two states away, and Gene's on the other side of the country. So it doesn't really work for us to get into the same room to do a video together. But Rich is also quite knowledgeable, and he actually does a very good job. You'll really find the video interesting. So in a future broadcast, I'll tell you more about that. A couple things that we've talked about in the past. You may recall a couple weeks ago we mentioned that there was a conviction in a case of counterfeiting. Bernard von Nothaus was found guilty in a federal court of counterfeiting the U.S. dollar by actually having the nerve to put out a so-called Liberty dollar that was made with actual silver and gold, and in fact is worth much more than any paper U.S. dollar. But they managed to convict him anyway. And the prosecutor in the case, prosecutor name was Ann Tompkins, made some rather interesting and perhaps controversial comments in her press conference after the conviction was gained. She basically said that what von Nothaus was engaging in was a form of terrorism. In other words, it's terrorism if you issue currency that's worth more than the currency you're trying to replace. Haven't quite figured that one out. I also saw an analysis by an attorney named Bill Rounds of the Liberty Dollar case, and particularly of comments that Ann Tompkins made. He has a slightly different emphasis and a different approach. I just want to read to you some of what he wrote in a blog entry on his blogging site. He wrote this on April 11th, so it's a little over a week ago, but it's still very interesting stuff. He says, Ann Tompkins' Liberty Dollar saga continues. Since the conviction of Bernard von Nothaus for his involvement, there has been significant discussion about the case, its merits, motivations, and implications. And contrary to the reports of many commentators, the legal issue in the case was fraud rather than a tyrannical government unjustly imposing its will. I'm not sure I'd agree with that, but nevertheless, we'll carry on with his analysis here. in a follow-up article called Liberty Dollar Part 3, which he's planning to write. He says he's going to go into much more detailed analysis of the relevant law and its constitutionality. But he says there is an aspect of this case that has the stench of tyranny, which I think a lot of people smell. The motivation of the United States Attorney's Office, including Ann M. Tompkins, Jill Westmoreland Rose, and others, is much more suspicious. It is possible, he writes, that some of the prosecutors involved in the case have violated rules of professional conduct. A violation could subject them to professional sanctions and possible disbarment, he says. They may have also defamed Mr. Von Nothaus. Interesting. I am approaching this professionally, he writes, from a criminal defense perspective and a plaintiff's tort lawyer, as if I were advocating for Mr. Von Nothaus. Next session, he entitles Prosecutors Made False Statements of Law in the Indictment. He writes, prosecutors indict people who they think have broken the law. The indictment is the legal justification for depriving people of their liberty and property. The indictment in the Liberty Dollar case, paragraph 33 of the indictment, states, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5 of the United States Constitution delegates the power to coin money and to regulate the value thereof. This power was delegated to Congress in order to establish and preserve a uniform standard of value, along with the power to coin money, and he has this now in emphasis. Congress has the concurrent power to restrain the circulation of money which is not issued under its own authority in order to protect and preserve the constitutional currency for the benefit of the nation. Thus, it is a violation of law for private coin systems to compete with the official coinage of the United States. Now, that's the quote that he read from the indictment. He says, there is no basis in the law or anywhere else which can support the part that he emphasized. Again, let me read that part one more time. Congress has a concurrent power to restrain the circulation of money which is not issued under its own authority in order to protect and preserve the constitutional currency for the benefit of the nation. Thus, it is a violation of law for private coin systems to compete with the official coinage of the United States. That's the section of the indictment he's taking issue with. In defense of his claims that there's a problem here, he writes, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5 of the U.S. Constitution says, the Congress shall have the power to coin money, regulate the value thereof and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures, unquote. And then he goes on to say the Constitution does not define what money, does not define what is money, only that it is something that is coined rather than printed, but instead leaves that critical choice to the free market. On its face, this clause gives the Congress the power to regulate the value of its own coinage and that of foreign coins. This section also goes on to talk about how Congress can legally define weights and measures like a foot, an inch, year, pound, kilogram, etc. There is absolutely no mention of the ability of Congress to do anything regarding private coin systems. Now, that's an interesting thing for an attorney to write. And Jake Town is now joining us. And, Jake, I'm glad you could make it to the show. I don't know how much of that you caught. But this particular attorney whose blog entry and writing says basically Von Nothaus has a basis for suing the prosecution because they had no right under the Constitution to prosecute him.
Well, yeah, it's a pretty nebulous area in terms of not too many people actually attempt it. And, for instance, we had Karen Emery of Del Valle Silver on our show probably at some point last year, and what she talked about was how she had an attorney go through all the laws and everything, and she was a private mint for silver coins, and there were some differences, like she wasn't calling, the coins were just marked with the weight of the silver, they weren't marked with dollars or liberty or anything like that, like United States coins are, like Von Nothaus had done, but yeah, sure, there's a definite case for those things.
And he also goes on to focus on the U.S. Code, Title 18, Section 486, which I've often focused on myself. And he says, even if we assume for the sake of argument that that section is constitutional, which he has questions about, he says there's no legal authority for restraining the circulation of money not issued under its own authority. That's an interesting claim. I'm not sure how he reads that. But according to him, that particular section of the law, Title 18, Section 486, appears to apply only to metal coins and not to other types of money or currency. Okay, I can kind of see that because it does specifically talk about coining gold and silver and circulating gold and silver money. And I think it's probably true that somebody could create their own paper money and not be in violation of the law. But the real question becomes, can somebody create a paper money that is backed by a gold or a silver under that law? And that's, I guess, the subject that is up for debate in many circles. There are a number of people who would say, well, it has to be a coin. It can't be just gold bullion or whatever. On the other hand, it struck me when I've read that title, and I've checked it a number of times, that the particular section of the law is referring to gold and silver, and that the purpose of the statute is to prevent the circulation of gold and silver. So, interesting viewpoint. I'm not sure exactly where it's all going to go, but I just thought I'd share that with the audience. And, Jake, I know we didn't have much of a chance to communicate beforehand. Have you had a chance to look in the headlines at all?
Well, you might have mentioned in the show so far, but I think since we're on the topic, we have some major financial headlines of gold hitting all-time highs and nominal dollars, hitting somewhere around $1,510 per troy ounce. And silver is at like a 31-year high.
Silver's flying. Oh, yeah.
$46.50 or thereabouts, and it's been a pretty interesting take on the markets, the gold and silver markets the past few days, as there really hasn't been too much hubbub about it. There, you know, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed fairly up. It's right around 12,500 based on earnings from Wall Street. So it's interesting how everything goes, and when you take a look at, for instance, dividing the Dow Jones Industrial Average by like an ounce of gold, whatever that dollar value happens to be at whatever point in time, what you see is a very sharply plummeting ratio, meaning that the Dow Jones Industrial Average, regardless of what the value is, 12,000, 13,000, 11,000, it's devaluing more and more in the face of gold.
Mm-hmm.
Really, again, what we've talked about on the show many times is it's not really anything going on other than the dollar being debased and destroyed and its purchasing power destroyed by the money printing powers of the Federal Reserve.
Exactly right. That's certainly what's driving this, although many commentators are trying to pretend that's not the case. I find the case of silver to be particularly fascinating because just, was it 2 months ago, silver was at $29 an ounce. Now it's at 46. I think it's at 46.63 is what it closed at today, 46.61 perhaps. And that's like what, a 50% increase in 2 months. I mean, that's not an active trading thing. That's like a skyrocket.
Oh yeah, yeah. The silver market has always been extremely volatile, and I think at some point it would be interesting to see a correction. But, people have been calling for corrections. There's some people that have been calling for corrections really since it hit $20, and they've been wrong really for the past 6 months or so.
Yeah, it's been quite dramatic. Probably the thing that's been most dramatic is what's happening to the gold and silver ratio. As I know you're aware, historically gold and silver were typically in a ratio of about 16 to 1, 1 ounce of gold versus 16 ounces of silver. As recently as, say, the time of the financial crisis, that ratio was closer to about 70 to 1. It's now down to about 32 to 1, and there is a lot of talk that it's on its way back to its traditional range of 16 to 1. If that happens, that means silver is exceeding $100 an ounce and closing in on 150. I mean, that starts to become pretty significant stuff at that point.
Oh, yeah, and it'll be the dynamics for both of the metals are different. Silver does have a large amount of industrial use where it's used and then pretty much not recycled. It's not cost-effective to do so, whereas gold really doesn't have too much industrial use. And, you know, what you're seeing is, like, when you take a look at a lot of the major places that sell physical gold or physical silver, whether it's a site like goldmoney.com or Sprott Money Asset Management, what they're reporting is that the dollar inflows from investors is about the same for silver as it is for gold. So we'll have to see where that takes us. But a lot of folks, you know, from the basis of the dollars, voting with their dollars, investors are thinking that silver is going to be going up a lot higher relative to gold.
Absolutely true, and I personally share that perspective. I think it's definitely true. An interesting thing happened regarding silver within the last couple of days. It turns out that Goldman Sachs, who of course is one of the primary dealers in the silver market, has basically run out of silver to short. In other words, when somebody wants to short a market, they have to basically have inventory that they can borrow against in order to do so, as you know. And apparently, there are so many people who've tried to short it, and the prices continue to go up anyway, that Goldman Sachs has actually run out of silver, publicly speaking, that they are able to provide to short sellers, which is really bad for short sellers because that means that the premium that they have to pay, anyone who takes a short position or buys an option arguing that there's going to be a drop in a price of an object has to pay a certain premium. They have to pay a certain extra amount in order for that transaction to take place. That premium has increased, so it has now become more expensive to short silver. And, of course, that's fueling the silver fires because now, of course, more and more people are saying, well, that means silver's on its way up. So fascinating things going on with the silver market. Something else I ran into, and Jake, you may already have known about this, but I have to admit I wasn't consciously aware of it. I may have been subconsciously aware of it. Did you know there's actually a gold currency in circulation in the, around the world today?
In terms of in, like, Malaysia or?
There is an Islamic gold coin that is in circulation, and yes, in Malaysia, that's one of the primary places where gold is being circulated. And it's actually working as a successful alternative currency, so to speak. It's not being circulated in a dramatic fashion, but some of the ways that it's being used, as a wealth preservative, as a protection against inflation. It's also being used within Islamic law. Of course, this is within Islamic nations that this coin is being circulated, within Islamic law to provide dowers for arranged marriages. There is some merchandise buying going on with it, but for the most part, it's being held as a counter to inflation. And it's also being it's becoming the basis for what they call holding accounts, which are for making and receiving payments. It's kind of in the sense of a gold exchange would be, or not a gold exchange, a gold standard would be. So not a whole lot of information is available about it, but I just found it fascinating in my research that there is actually a market for gold that is evolving. And despite all of the propaganda that is thrown at us about how bad radical Islam is and so on and so forth, I find it fascinating that it is within the Islamic culture that the gold coin is first becoming a medium of exchange.
Right, and I had read about that at some point last year. I haven't been following the story recently. I think Nepal is another country where they're starting to move a little bit towards that. But in Malaysia, the gold dirham, and they also have a silver coin that they're using, as you mentioned, for theological reasons, but also for economic reasons. What's funny is that the Bank of Negara, which is the Malaysian central bank, these coins are only circulating in one state in Malaysia, and the central bank is acting against it pretty harshly to try and get rid of it, but it has a lot of the support of the people, and they're just not able to really, Malaysia is a little bit of a different country compared to the U.S., and they're just not really able to stop people from circulating these coins.
And an interesting thing I noted is that I don't remember which blog entry I saw it in, but one person was pointing out that it's not just the one state now that is going to circulate the coin. There are apparently two other Malaysian states that are talking about circulating the dinar coin and issuing their own version of it. So apparently the pro-gold side is starting to gain some speed in Malaysia. I don't know if you'd heard about that one.
No, I haven't.
So I thought that was very interesting. Meanwhile, of course, here in the U.S., we're still dealing with the coming ramp-up in inflation, and people, of course, are still unemployed, and the real estate market's still in tatters, and the economy's still in tatters, and we're dealing with it on a variety of fronts. And, Jake, I understand that the Reverend Jesse Jackson has weighed in on one of these fronts. What are the details on that?
Oh, yeah, a report from the Huffington Post this week was last Friday, Congressman Jesse Jackson, Jr., a Democrat from Illinois, addressed the United States and talked about the unemployment crisis. And today we just had new numbers out, unemployment claims report at 403,000, which is for new claims, which is quite frankly not good. He claimed that the iPad from the Apple Corporation was, quote, probably responsible for eliminating thousands of American jobs.
Okay, I got to hear this.
He did a speech before Congress where, and ironically, he himself does, in fact, own an iPad. expanded on his statement by pointing to the recent bankruptcy of Borders Books. And he said, you know, why do you, quote, why do you need to go to Borders anymore? Why do you need to go to Barnes & Nobles? Just buy an iPad and download your book, download your newspaper, download your magazine, unquote.
Oh, I see.
He also said that Chicago State University has an initiative to replace textbooks with iPads for freshman students. And anyone attending college will be very well aware it's not uncommon to pay well over $100 for a textbook. And in a semester, it can run a student easily thousands of dollars. He stated that the goal of the university was to create a textbookless campus within 4 years. Jackson then said, what becomes of publishing companies and publishing company jobs? What becomes of bookstores and librarians and all the jobs associated with paper? Well, in the not-too-distant future, such jobs simply won't exist. So it's very interesting to see the very plainly ignorant, from watching his speech live on the House floor, talks about economics, because quite obviously, when you don't have to worry about, generating all this paper and shipping all this paper and all this other stuff, those very same resources can be used doing different things. So where Representative Jackson is correct is that when you look at the special interests of one group, which may be the people employed by Borders Books or in the publishing industries, it might not be beneficial at all. In that way, he's correct. But in the big term, the big frame, the big picture, what we will have is those same people and many others will be able to do quite a bit more. I mean, you had the same exact thing happen in the United States when the car came out to replace the horse and buggy, and you had all these people talking, you know, what are these horse and buggy drivers going to do? How are we going to replace the horse whip industry? And what are we going to do with all these horses? And it's, it's pretty sad to see that, part of the reason that we're in such an economic mess is that these folks just keep doing all these interventions that act to keep the American people down and unemployed and not being able to use things to make their lives easier.
Yeah, the really sad part is that by trying to blame the iPad, he's diverting attention away from what the real problem is. And he's also ignoring the fact that Apple employs people to build the iPad and to distribute it. That doesn't seem to enter into his economic calculations. He kind of ignored that, and did he ignore the Amazon Kindle and the Android and all these other devices that are being created? I mean, there are people behind them who are actually, earning a living doing that.
He sardonically kind of points out that a lot of the jobs are being generated in places such as China and Taiwan. And there, he does have a decent point. But again, why are the jobs going over there? And the reason is that we have so many barriers set up to corporations, not just on the technology front, but just, in terms of all these things that you need to do to set up a new company, Sarbanes-Oxley, where we just have accountants employed doing pretty much just busy work. It's really killing our economy. And it's quite interesting that Henry Hazlitt, an economist that used to write for the New York Times back when it was a respectable newspaper, which was a long time ago, wrote about how, what you have is the seen and the unseen. And just because you see the impact on one group, the unseen effects are quite a bit different. And that's what Congress and really any of the current, and this also includes most of, believe it or not, academia and economics, they fail to see those that very simple principle that you have to assess the effects on the entire economy, not just on a special group.
That's absolutely true. And we're actually, I think, starting to reach the point where the ability of China to price manufacturing so much lower than the rest of the world is probably coming to an end, because they're already going through their own inflation period. They've had tremendous growth. wages have been rising. They're probably getting closer and closer to the point where they're just not going to be able to suck the jobs offshore like they used to. I mean, maybe you see it differently, but that's the way I'm looking at it these days.
Well, there's also, and again, the Western media doesn't report about it a whole much, but there was something called the Jasmine Revolution in China back in February, where you had massive protests against the government, and really for economic reasons, and I would say almost solely economic reasons. And just yesterday, truck drivers blockaded the port of Waigaoqiao in the main free trade zone in Shanghai, China, which employs, I believe, over a million workers. And I was actually spent 4 years abroad working over there as an engineer myself. And the workers' complaints were that they weren't able to get by on their wages and were for higher wages. And, you know, just as you said, the government with their central bank has been raising the reserve requirements, which is another way of just trying to cut down on the amount of loans and the amount of money created out of thin air by the banking system. They're actively trying to put the brakes on it. But it's pretty serious. And like you said, there's a lot of things going on. But the other thing is also civil unrest. And, you know, whether we've seen the end of cheap goods made in China, I would say, you know, in the short term, definitely not. But in the long term, China's got just as many problems with central planning as we do here with our government trying to get in our way.
Absolutely true. I think that we should also point out that there's another factor in the foreign trade equation, if you will, that usually gets ignored by all sides, liberal, conservative, moderate, everything in between, and that's the role of patents, copyrights, and trademarks, particularly patents and copyrights. The patent system as it's structured right now under American law basically forces Americans to pay higher prices than anyone else around the world for electronic goods and other goods coming out of China. And not just out of China, but out of Singapore and Malaysia and all the places around the world that do the major manufacturing. The patent laws are basically designed to allow the manufacturers to charge the most money that they can possibly get. It's not designed to actually reward the creators. It's rather designed to reward the corporations that buy up the patents so that they can corner the market and basically force the price up. Most people don't realize, what do we pay for a TV? I mean, if you go to a Walmart or a Best Buy or something like that, you know, the low-end TVs are going to be maybe $250, and the high-end TVs are going to be up in the thousands. But when you look at what it actually costs to manufacture them, either in China or here in the United States, the actual cost is fairly low compared to the price tag. What allows them to charge these high prices despite the so-called competition is the fact that they're able to use the patent law to force the price to be high because no one else is allowed to produce their new idea until the patent has expired some, 8 or 10 years later or whatever the current time frame is. And the way that they get around that expiration is they're constantly adding new innovations, so that means they get the patented all over again. So it's a constant series of patents, or in the case of software, constant series of copyrights, an endless series of copyrights, which means it's an endless series of cornering the market. When you do that, you're going to end up with high prices, and that's exactly what we have.
That's a good point. I think you're kind of peeling away the layers of onion that's surrounding the real problem in our country, and that's that the corporations really control the two gangs of political groups that run our country, both the Democrats and Republicans both, and until there's something that happens to try and oppose them and really look out for the interests of the American people and really kind of abide by the rule of law, which is, you know, the government, in my view, does have a role, which is to act as an enforcer when contracts are broken and when fraud is initiated and when there's theft and assaults and that sort of thing. But and all other things, let there be no barriers to the competitiveness, because the end result is that the consumer are the ones that make out from all this.
I want to go into more detail about patents and copyrights, but I think we should get a quick break in here so that PRN can do some promos. And when we get back after the break, I'm going to just talk a little bit more in detail about why I think that the copyright and patent laws need to be reworked, because right now, frankly, they're working against our best interests. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown on the Progressive Radio Network. We'll be back after these messages. Don't you know talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper while they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know talking about a revolution sounds.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Hello, I'm Carol Brier, host of Community Currency, connecting people, ideas, important information, nurturing human renaissance, seeking to transform disintegrating empire into healthy, problem-solving, creative, evolutionary, peaceful communities. To hear us, listen every Thursdays, 5 to 6 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, this is Eric Ofner, your host of the best jazz show on the air on Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
Progressive Radio Network. This is the number one radio station for progressive independent thinkers.
Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds.
It sounds like we're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Jake Town and Walt Thiessen. And Jake, before the break, we were talking a little bit about patents and copyrights. A point I wanted to make in more detail. When we first in this country and even in other countries around the world explored the idea of copyrighting and patenting new ideas, new innovations, the motivation behind it was that very often in the past anyway, people who were innovators sometimes were left out of the picture when it came to earning money off of the ideas that led to, you know, great advances for society. So they figured, well, we should have patents and copyrights in order to protect them. We have completely gotten away from that. At least that's my view. It's gotten to the point now where it almost doesn't matter whether or not the innovator makes out well. What matters is whether or not the idea can be traded to a corporation so that the corporation can get rich, which really, as far as I can see, it violates the very principle of what a copyright and a patent is supposed to do. Not to say that people who create new ideas don't ever get rich. They do. Not that they don't get rewarded. They do. But when the whole thing turns into a corner of the market scheme, from my view, I think that's when we have to take another look and say, wait a minute, this is not going quite the way we had anticipated, and perhaps we can do it better. What, I mean, do you see it differently?
Well, you know, it's something that, you know, when you read through the Constitution, it's one of those things that's in there that Congress was given the right over patents and everything. And, It's something that I myself haven't completely come to grips with, because certainly, like you said, maybe 100 years ago, having a patent for a certain number of years on a book or an invention or something may make sense. But in today's world, like you said, it is just kind of used in a lot of cases by these companies to block their competitors. And a lot of times what is used as corporate strategy is patenting things for the express purpose of blocking the competitor from making a technological advancement and moving things along in that way. So, yeah, for sure, it's a definite mixed bag between protecting the what was created and from the person that has that, and then also trying to get to the point where we aren't just stagnating everything.
And it strikes me that it really isn't necessary to take the tack that we've taken, because if the sole purpose is to reward the creator for creating the idea, why does that reward have to come from only one source? I mean, that's basically what the present system is founded on, the idea that the funding has that the reward has to come from one source, from the company that he sells his idea to. The question that I would raise is, why not change the way that we think about patents and copyrights? Instead of it being like a piece of property, like a piece of land or a gold coin or a packet of food or whatever, why not think of it as something that is leased out, that is licensed out? I mean, that's the way we treat it. We always treat it in terms of licensing. Why not make it so that anybody can license the idea, provided that they reimburse the creator of the idea? That way, you can't corner the market anymore, but the creator still gets rewarded.
Oh, sure. That's a definite, stop talking reason, Walt.
Sorry. I didn't realize we were supposed to be talking gibberish on this show.
No, it's a definite, very good point. And when you take a look at a lot of things that are in our society today, whether it's the number of gallons that your toilet flushes or just about anything, it's all affected really by patent law. And in most cases, I would say I think you're correct in that it's in a way that's not very beneficial to the person and probably also the creator of the idea.
And it also strikes me that the way that this whole patent copyright thing works and the way it basically rewards the rich, it plays in very nicely to the financial system, don't you think? I mean, a system that's designed to create as much money as possible through the issuance of as much debt as possible to finance large corporations so that they can corner the market.
And by their politicians, yeah, all in one shot.
And, of course, we get to pay the consequences of that as individuals. One way that that's happening, and you and I have been talking about this for quite some time, but we're now starting to see signs of it. The U.S. Dollar and the U.S. economy is starting to lose its grip on being the reserve currency of the world, and we're starting to see that through the S&P. What are the details on that, on the downgrade or the potential downgrade coming from the S&P?
Well, Standard & Poor's, which I will add as a little bit of a caveat, which completely missed the housing crisis, did this week announce that it has revised its outlook on the U.S. sovereign debt, in other words, the Treasury market, from stable to negative, which means that after a certain number of months, I believe it's 1 to 2 years, if nothing changes, S&P will downgrade the Treasury market from AAA to something lower, which is a pretty serious outlook. I think the only question that probably the both of us would have is, what took them so long?
Yes.
But it's interesting, where this is coming in is you had President Obama addressing the nation last week. You had Representative Ryan from the Republican Party coming out with the Republicans' efforts at trying to cut the budget and put everything into play. And obviously there does appear to be a bit of a deadlock. The Democrats want to roughly maintain or cut spending a little bit while vastly increasing taxes on the rich. I think I'm just kind of paraphrasing the Democrats' plan. And in the Republicans' plan, they roughly want to cut the spending, but not by a whole lot. And
they have to actually be able to claim they cut spending so they can go trumpet it to their supporters.
Right. But I think S&P and really I think the investing world just kind of looked at that and was like, this isn't good. And that's part of the reason that things are kind of playing out that way. And, you know, even the Ryan plan that's trumpeted, you know, demonized by the Democrats, when you take a look at it, it's not really going to alter the path. Like, we're still under the Ryan plan. We still would be running budgets from deficits of $1 trillion through 2012, $700 billion, so 0.7 trillion in 2013, about a half a trillion in 2014, about a half a trillion in 2015 and 2016. And when you get out to 2017 to 2021, you're talking still $400 billion deficits all the way out.
And these are the most positive numbers.
Right. And really, when you take a look at it, the Ryan plan is unfortunately far too moderate. It's not going, it really wouldn't even work with what they have planned. So it's going to be interesting to see how things go. But really, what you're seeing is that we have a fiscal train wreck happening here where neither party really has a clue on what to do.
Unfortunately, that is the case. And once again, that's a train wreck that you and I and everybody else, all the individuals in the country, will end up paying for. And it's frustrating because you and I know what's been going on. We've known for some time what's been going on. We've created the show so that we can help other people know what's going on. And yet, despite the fact that we know, sometimes I feel semi-helpless because we know the mess is coming. We know the train wreck is coming. We know the catastrophe is coming. And we're almost powerless to stop it. I guess, you know, I don't even know why I mentioned that except to point out that, you know, I feel the frustration that many of our listeners probably feel in trying to get our minds around what's going on and how we're going to address it as individuals. I guess what I'm leading up to is the only thing that's left is what we talked about at the beginning of the show, which is alternative money, because that's what's driving the whole thing. It's the monetary system. And it means that you have to have gold and silver as money if you're going to be able to get anywhere. And I think that maybe the one good thing that comes out of this is maybe we do end up getting driven back to using gold and silver as money just as a matter of necessity, because once the U.S. dollar goes down the toilet, there's really no other fiat currency that can replace it.
Yeah, no, that's completely the truth, because when currencies go haywire, in other words, when you have things such as hyperinflation and the currency gets destroyed, when this happens in, you know, banana republics such as Zimbabwe and Argentina and a lot of the other South American countries over the past, you know, very recently and through the last couple decades, they tend to use the dollar to kind of stabilize things that are going on. But you bring up a very good point. You know, what if all the paper currencies are seen as unstable? And what you'll have then is a, you know, full-fledged panic. And I think that's what the monetary authorities and the central banks are really trying to pretend or to prevent. Like the job of the
central
bank.
Well, you're right on both counts. They're pretending and they're preventing.
Yeah. The central bank's job is to destroy the currency, but at a rate slow enough that the population can't really see what's going on. And
that's very well stated.
And to maintain the immense debt that you know, the $14, $15, you know, it'll be $20 trillion before we know it, national debt. You know, they can't allow real positive interest rates on any of that debt. Otherwise, it'll completely sink them. That's what you're seeing. I think if you took a look at, you know, well, a lot of times when you have these defaults, you know, I think we should also add, it happens incredibly suddenly. Like, there's not going to be time for too much of anything. And I think that, like, for instance, in Greece is sort of tied into the European Union. But when you look at their two-year version of a sovereign debt note from the Greek government, the interest rates are well over 20%, and that's not sustainable. Greece is sinking, and if they weren't, you know, kind of tied up by the rest of the EU, they'd be falling apart. And, you know, there was a recent election in Finland, of all places, and the Finns elected a minority party called the True Finns, a bit of a nationalist party. Then their one thing on their platform that had the appeal, like they talk about, they were very anti-immigration, a few other things, but the only thing that really mattered on their ticket was that they were against bailouts. They were against authorizing the European Central Bank to bail out, whether it's Greece or Spain or Portugal or any of these other countries that have just been, fiscally very irresponsible at the expense of the Finnish people. So this minority party has kind of exploded, and I don't think they got control of the parliament, but they went from basically nothing to a very sizable voice in just one snap election. And I think that's, what we're going to see is a lot of political unrest. And for our listeners, you have to, question, what exactly can you do? And really, the thing is, the things that can be done is to, save yourself first. You need to be your own central banker. Don't just listen to Walt and I, look into this whole gold and silver thing and come to your own decisions. But, and protect your family as well. And hopefully, we'll be able to get through all this before things get a heck of a lot worse.
And that actually is the most important point. The fact that is that if we can get off of this dollar system and get into a currency that is level and stable and can't easily be manipulated like gold, like silver, a lot of these problems go away really quickly. I mean, they go away surprisingly quickly. And I'm beginning to take some heart from the fact that gold and silver, for instance, is no longer just a gold bug investment. It's not just the gold bugs who are buying gold. Recent news coming out this past week that the University of Texas is taking on delivery of 6,643 gold bars worth nearly $1 billion. I mean, that's a huge investment for the second largest endowment in the country. University of Texas' endowment is second only to Harvard University. And they're basically putting 1/20th of their entire assets into physical gold. To me, that's quite possibly the start of institutional investment in gold on a significant basis, and I kind of suspect we're going to see quite a bit of it, not just in gold but in silver in the coming months, which of course means that it's going to be very bullish for a continued rise in the price of gold and silver.
Right, and again, with all these things kind of going on with the gold and silver prices, one only can, predict, a lot of things that we, pay attention to what we talked about, what's going on in Libya, for instance. We're bombing Libya every day. That's very expensive. We talked about a couple weeks ago where President Obama gave a secret order to authorize unknown amounts of either aid or arms to the Libyan rebels in a very bloody civil war. What are they fighting over, like 1% of the world's oil supply? But what also just happened is that U.S. Predator drones have been authorized by President Obama and Secretary of Defense, Secretary Robert Gates, to carry out missions in Libya. So, again, we will be, expending American tax dollars in something that has completely of no use to the American people. And just like you said with, gold and silver, when you take a look at if you do a vast survey, like the University of Texas is really one of the first major institutions of its kind to kind of come out with that, the majority of institutions have nothing in gold. World assets is far below 1% in gold and silver. And if you go back even several decades, that was up somewhere around 5%. So really, at least until you get to those types of levels, the situation is very bullish on both gold and silver. And for any listeners that want to learn more, in the back archives of our show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, you have an interview that we did with Bill Murphy of the group GATA at Gold Antitrust Action Committee, GATA.org, GATA.org, where he told us really the case for the gold and silver prices being manipulated by the governments.
Which means that ultimately it's one more stimulus behind the gold and silver prices going upward. It seems like all the forces are aligned so that gold and silver are going to skyrocket and continue to skyrocket. And for those people who are trying to figure out how can they protect themselves, well, silver is still relatively affordable. That might be a way to do it. You can go buy silver eagles at most coin dealers, and there's still a fairly good supply, although the supply is
is starting to dry up, and as institutional interest comes in, it's going to dry up very quickly. But there's still an opportunity to buy Silver Eagle, so there's a way that one, that people can at least provide some protection for themselves. I want to share one other thing that comes from Congressman Ron Paul, who you and I have both talked about in very favorable terms over the months and over the past year. This is something that actually comes from his House of Representatives website. Of course, every congressman has their own website. And this is an article that he put out that is entitled, Budget Cuts Are Meaningless Without Fed Transparency. And boy, if that doesn't tie in directly to what we've talked about, I don't know what does. But let me just read a couple of paragraphs from this. He writes, Congress focused on issues surrounding government spending this week as talk of deficits, the national debt, and the debt limit saturated the airwaves. This is a positive development. In years past, there was very little concern over how much was spent here in Washington, how it was spent, or how much of our gross domestic product was being consumed by government. That blissful ignorance naturally resulted in decades of government spending with impunity, bringing us to where we are today, trillions in debt with astronomical entitlement obligations that will be impossible to fulfill in the not-too-distant future. So it is a good thing, he writes, that there is so much political pressure now on our leaders to actually put the brakes on runaway spending. However, even the most generous estimate of the spending cut passed this week, $38.5 billion, is a paltry 3.5% of the $1.05 trillion in spending for the next 5 years. This hardly makes a dent in our government's mountain of debt. Even worse than that, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, stripped away the accounting sleights of hand and scored it as only a $352 million in cuts. That's something you were referring to earlier, Jake, which works out to less than half of 1% of spending. And still, the tiniest cut is better than the massive increases we have become accustomed to. Of course, our disastrous wars in Afghanistan and Iraq are not even included in this budget, as they are considered emergency spending. They constitute $3.3 billion in spending in the same period of time, so they more than cancel out any small cuts the warmongers may crow about. He goes on to say, I voted against the legislation funding government for the remainder of this year as well as next year's budget because, as in past years, government spends far too much on unconstitutional programs. In spite of any rhetoric about fiscal responsibility at 0.3% does not suddenly make the rest of the spending constitutional or responsible. Then I want to skip a paragraph and go down to where he says, the unelected, unaccountable Fed hands out as much or more money as our federal government spends and yet receives hardly any attention. And this is why I believe transparency of the Fed is a critical step to regaining control of our financial situation in this country. We can never get meaningful reforms if all eyes are on the $352 million so-called cuts, and transactions like the $220 million given to Wall Street cronies are done in the shadows. This is why I have introduced my audit the Fed bill to Congress. H.R. 1207 is now H.R. 459 and is essential to true fiscal reform and responsibility. So I mentioned that as we're nearing the end of our program today, to kind of give a positive spin and say, hey, at least there is somebody standing up for us in Washington. And Jake, I'm sure you feel very much the same way.
Oh, yeah, no, Ron Paul has been a stalwart defender of American liberty, really, for the past 30 years in Congress. As a matter of fact, I only kind of feel sorry that he was talking about this for 30 years, and I didn't really even hear the man really till 2007 or so. And
yeah, unfortunately, the media did nothing to help him get the message out. They did everything they could to squelch him. His own party tried to squelch him, and it's really a sad thing that it has taken this long for the message to get out, but at least it's getting out. And,
yeah, we'll have to see, because, you know, he has plans to run for president, possibly. I don't think there's been an official announcement, but certainly things are developing in that way. And I believe also former governor of, I believe it's Arizona, Gary Johnson, is also considering running for the Republican nomination, and it seems that their only serious competition is Donald Trump.
Yeah, I can see us supporting him. Sure. Well, we're running out of time here. We've got about a minute or two left. One other thing that I wanted to touch on very, very briefly, and again, I'm not sure if this is something you knew about, but Jake, did you know that central banks have turned into net buyers of gold over the last year?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, particularly when you look at the Russian central bank, and at least on the European side, they stopped selling. And countries such as China are very vigorously trying to obtain enough gold and silver to bolster their reserves and kind of back their currencies. Because, again, just as you as a private individual and I myself as a private individual view gold and silver as ways to conserve purchasing power, the central banks view it as a insurance policy in case their paper currencies don't really work out.
Well, it turns out that it's not only Russia and China and those few that have been involved in it, but now apparently Australia and Canada their central banks are involved in buying gold and silver. And though we don't get any real read on it from the American banks, I would not be surprised if the American banks, particularly the Federal Reserve, is also buying gold and silver, which raises a question in my mind. The question is this: if the current monetary system is so good, and of course these are all advocates of the current monetary system, why is it that they're all buying the one form of money that they've all rejected? Because there's not a single central bank on the face of the earth that does not reject the use of gold and silver as money, and yet they're all investing in it.
Well, it's intentionally misleading. I mean, you know, the Fed's coming out with these press conferences right there to kind of, you know, persuade the masses. But, yeah, you bring up a very good point. Like, it would be very interesting to actually see some of these directors and so-called governors of the Federal Reserve and see what they actually hold in their bank accounts and safes. You might be kind of shocked by what we see.
I think one thing that we should do is, even though they haven't been telling us to, that we should probably follow their example. If the central banks, given all that they know about what is going on with the monetary system, have chosen to start investing in gold and silver, which works antithetically to their own system, that should be a signal to the rest of us. It's time to buy gold and silver. It's time to accumulate whatever we can afford to accumulate so that when the spam hits the fan, we're ready for it as much as any of us can possibly be ready for it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we're down to the last minute or so here. I do want to urge you to visit the website during the week to check out upcoming guests. We don't currently have a guest scheduled for next week, but you never know. During the week, one of us is sometimes able to schedule somebody, and we will immediately put it up on the website. So check out the website at www.freedomnewshour.com. And by the way, even if you don't see any news about guests, you'll see a couple of very good videos there that we've referenced on previous programs. One of them is actually quite humorous, quite amusing, and well worth the time to watch. And Jake, I'll also mention to you what I mentioned to our audience earlier before you came on. I'm actually in the process of working on a video version of the Freedom News Hour with a friend of mine here in Warrington, where I live, and that's going to be coming out sometime in May, talking more about the monetary system. So there'll be one more video we can put on the website, something more to look forward to. Well, we've reached the end of the hour. Jake, it's been a pleasure as usual. Thanks for joining us today, and thank you, listeners, for joining us. We'll see you next week here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Take care, everyone.
Gonna rise up, get there, yeah. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs.